Yeah, but in real life, you're lawful evil. Neutral evil.
I'm not neutral evil, you jerk.
Lawful evil.
I'm not lawful either.
Chaotic evil? You're not chaotic evil.
Not evil.
What? Wait. What?
Live from the Mundangerous Corn Maze in New York City, I'm your host Shane.
And I'm your host Ishan.
And welcome to episode 13 of Total Party Thrill, a podcast for game masters and players where we discuss our campaigns in order to inspire yours.
In this episode, we're talking about alignment and how it affects your characters. But first, the Morning Glory campaign crosses a river, and our smuggler hides some contraband in the Character Creation Forge.
I think it's fitting that we're on unlucky number 13, just before Halloween.
Dun dun dun.
And you know what's coming out soon?
The Sword Coast Adventurer's Guide.
Are you psyched?
I mean, considering the last episode we complained about how the, you know, new material that we're getting from Wizards is slow but not steady. Yeah, I'm super excited.
Did you see the previews? Because I think that'll temper your excitement a little bit.
I saw the previews. I wish I hadn't seen the previews.
So Wizards released 4 preview pages from the book as part of their Extra Life campaign, which is cool that they're raising money for charity, but is a little cause for concern from us because the previews, not so exciting.
Yeah, so let's rip those up. Let's talk about those.
All right, where do you want to start?
Let's start at the beginning, yeah? Green Flame Blade.
It's a cantrip.
Yeah. It's interesting. So you cast the spell, and then it makes you make a melee attack.
Right.
And then you deal that damage normally, and then a creature next to the one that you hit takes some fire damage.
Yeah, and that amount of fire damage scales with the level of the cantrip.
As does the amount of damage that you do with that melee attack.
Right.
Right.
I think it's useful for rogues. It costs a rogue nothing if you're an arcane trickster to get it.
Yeah, and you know, potentially do a little bit of extra damage, although
situationally.
Yeah, it's dependent on having two enemies standing next to each other.
Right. Yeah, I know. It's not an every down play.
Yeah.
But it's a
Also I think it looks silly in my head.
The mechanics are getting a little more esoteric.
It is really complicated for a cantrip. That's a lot of text.
Right.
Plus having to do, okay, let's see, 1d8 plus my spellcasting modifier, and then increase that by, wait, hold on, what?
Yeah, I know.
Yeah.
And there have already been questions of Jeremy Crawford on Twitter asking how this interacts with different feats. So Warcaster or Polearm Master, mm-hmm. It's like, ugh.
When you design a game that is supposed to have natural language and doesn't rely on keywords and all that kind of thing, don't come up with something so complicated.
I know.
That is both a melee attack and a spell and a cantrip and skills.
Okay. So,
yeah, that's not the worst.
This isn't the worst thing that we've seen.
Yeah, like it'll work for some characters. I'm sure we'll have something in the Forge that uses it.
Right.
Yeah.
Probably not going to have anything in the Forge using Mastermind.
Take anything but Mastermind.
So Mastermind is a rogue archetype. So it's a subclass available to you if you want to be terrible at everything.
Right. Hey, you get 2 languages. There's some neat flavorful abilities, right?
Yeah, but for a class that needs every little bit of help it can get, flavorful abilities don't really float.
Right, that's the problem. The flavorful abilities replace the mechanical advantages.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. So yeah, level 3, you get Disguise Kit, Forgery Kit, a couple languages, and you can mimic speech patterns. That's super cool. Yeah, neat. Right, but that's no Assassinate.
Right, right. you also get Master of Tactics, so you can use the help action as a bonus action.
Yay. Why is that not on a fighter warlord?
I spend my bonus to give you advantage.
I mean, I'll probably... I would love to use that along with Battlemaster Fighter in order to make a warlordy character, but that then locks me into the terrible, terrible mastermind path.
Yeah.
Yeah, because, so at 9 you get Insightful Manipulator. This is a bit like Know Your Enemy from level 7 Battlemaster Fighter.
Yeah.
and very DM dependent. And then at level 13, misdirection, which is horribly, horribly awful.
It triggers when you're using another creature for cover, which, you know, is very flavorful. Like, I love the idea of the mastermind who throws his minion in front of him and uses him as cover. But how many times have you ever triggered the creature cover rules in 5e?
Yeah, also, like, if you throw your ally in front of you...
not going to be your ally much longer.
Right. And why would an enemy be attacking you when their ally is providing you cover? They would just move.
Right, right.
It's never going to happen. And it's level 13.
I know. But you know what's worse? At level 17, you get Soul of Deceit. Your thoughts can't be read by telepathy unless you allow it.
Okay. Cool and flavorful. And you can trick magic that determines if you're telling the truth.
Oh, okay. So you can trick a second level spell, Zone of Truth. Great.
Yeah,
you're level 17. You know who else can do that? Any level 9 caster, any level 8 caster, anyone with the spell magic, frankly.
I basically gave you this ability as part of the Epic Destinies that I created for you guys.
Yeah.
Yeah. And
super flavorful.
And I counted it as a very, very small amount of the total package.
Right.
We'll actually talk about that in a later episode when we talk about Epic Destinies. I actually broke down all of the abilities that you guys got and gave them a numerical value and then added them all up. And this was not worth much at all.
No.
It's no Death Strike.
It's no Death Strike. It's no fifth level spells. Isn't that what the Arcane Trickster has?
Yeah.
Whatever it is. Maybe third level spells, but regardless.
Yeah, fifth level.
This is...
what were they thinking? Like, this is published.
Okay, so here's the thing. Everyone knows that they've cut the D&D team at Wizards of the Coast down to 4 people.
Yeah. So
this book was outsourced to Green Ronin, and I love Green Ronin's work.
And yes, I agree.
Chris Premus is great. I think he's an awesome designer. They got far away from the core of D&D. That's my concern, is they've taken everything that was great about 5e being very simplified core mechanics.
Right, and streamlined, easy to run.
Right. And now they're finding new ways to implement different things. It's not going to work. Or it's not going to be fun for me as a player trying to cipher through all this stuff.
I could even understand if it were power creep, right? But it's the opposite.
Yeah, it's like power scramble. Like, I don't know if it's better or worse. It's just... much more difficult to interpret.
Right. So don't be the mastermind.
They also released a new background, the Urban Bounty Hunter, which is a really cool background, but mm-hmm.
It's a background.
Yeah, it's a background.
Yeah, you make them up.
You could just do that on your own. Uh-huh. So, all right. So we know we're not seeing any new races. We know we're not seeing any new psionics. What are we going to see in this book?
Well, hold on. We'll get the Durgar, yeah?
Isn't that a dwarf?
It is two dwarves as drow are two elves.
Yeah, aren't drow elves?
They, you know, they get different entries, right? But
okay.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, I don't know. Is it going to be a race entry or is it going to be a subrace?
I guess we could look at the...
oh, including subrace traits. No, yeah, it's going to be a full-on separate race, which is, I guess, makes sense because they have crazy powers, right? Like the psionic enlarge.
No, it's not. It's
it's just a subrace of dwarf?
It's a subrace of dwarf,
wah,
yeah.
Wah,
wah.
Which means you got to give up all the other dwarf stuff in order to lose your hair and be gray.
Well, I mean, they released the table of contents. So we know that there's stuff for every class has something in it, either new subclasses or in the case of Warlock, they have new patrons. So, you know, right. We'll see what they have.
Yes, I'm super interested. We're going to have a lot of new material for the Forge. I'm happy for new feats. Yeah, these are going to be hopefully very interesting. It's just... I don't know why they chose to preview this stuff. It doesn't make me excited.
No, it really doesn't. But, you know, who knows? 150 pages. 158 pages is the index. So
in a future episode, we're going to dig through the entire thing and give you a full-on review of it.
Yeah. And hopefully we can be much more positive than we were now because...
because we love D&D and we love 5e. Or yeah. We want to love it more than we do sometimes.
Yeah, agreed. Yeah. So, speaking of something we love... where are we in the Morn and Glory campaign?
Ah, yes, the Mornland. Eberron's answer to Ravenloft. The party had just crossed the dead gray mist and finally found their way through its disorienting effects, avoiding multiple types of rain. Acid rain, blood rain, bone rain. All the rains. passed through the Bleeding Forest and made their way to the edge of where they thought the capital of Seer, before it was destroyed, Metrol, had been. However, the ruins seem to have been moved 10 miles or so.
Weird.
So they set out across the blighted wasteland and encountered many creepy things, many of which were drawn from the 1001 Creepy Things in the Mornland thread from the old Wizards of the Coast forums, which are dying an ignoble death.
That's true.
I hope someone saves that information, because, man, that was great stuff, including many of the ideas that I either stole wholesale or tweaked a bit to make the Mornland just a bit creepier, like when they walked by ruined walls, sometimes just the shadows of children playing and people going about their daily lives would walk past on the walls over and over again. But didn't really do anything else, or did it?
Ugh, there were flying corpse hands.
So, right, the thick thing from the Addams Family, and there's two of them sort of attached at the wrist, and that creates this flapping effect so that they fly, and then of course they grab you around your neck.
Lovely.
Every time they came across a food or a body, it was completely unspoiled and not rotted, which is a thing that happens, or I suppose doesn't happen, in the Mornland. Nothing rots, nothing spoils, it just stays dead.
Yeah, that's normal. Yeah, totally casual,
no biggie.
Just like the city blocks that have been rotated randomly.
Yes. Random city blocks rotated 90 degrees, 180 degrees here and there. So, of course, this is was originally the home city of the paladin Kallik. So he's returning here. He knows these streets. He thinks he should be able to navigate where you're trying to get to, which is the Lightning Rail station. But he's finding that he's just as disoriented, perhaps even more so sometimes than the rest of you, because everything's just slightly too familiar, but then doesn't make any sense.
And then perhaps the most bizarre of all, the river that turned us to gold.
We didn't know that at first.
Oh, we found out.
So the city is in ruins, and they come to a river crossing, right? For a while, they've been hearing bubbling, moving water. And it seems like a pretty normal river that's been, you know, carved out in the middle of these two city blocks. It's about 50 feet wide, but pretty slow moving. And suspended in the air above it, slowly, like lazily drifting, are what look like hundreds of fireflies. And of course, upon closer examination, they're not fireflies. They're tiny, multicolored motes of what look like, upon very close examination, letters, characters in script.
In draconic script?
Multiple, many different kinds of scripts. If you look for it, you probably see it.
So, yeah.
If only you had had a rune scribe.
Oh, yeah, that would have been really handy. We could have identified this was, in fact, a living glyph of warding.
Yes, so that was essentially the answer to the puzzle. One of the effects of the Mornland is that it sometimes takes spells that were active at the time and warps them into living creatures. It was actually a template in 3.5, and so I homebrewed it into a trap.
Yeah, I actually wasn't there for that session.
I thought that was interesting because of all the players, you were the one most likely to sort of mess with things and ask ridiculous questions, which probably would have been helpful in this particular scenario.
I also had a really, really high Arcana skill.
That's true.
Which wouldn't have hurt either.
Right. I do believe they eventually did figure out that it was a living glyph of warding.
But they didn't think to not read the glyph.
Yeah, so that was the trick. Close your eyes.
Yeah.
Right. So
it's hard to swim across a river with your eyes closed.
It's true. It's true. And it's not necessarily something that you think of, right?
Yeah.
Like hold your breath isn't necessarily a thing that comes to mind. Yeah.
Well,
there's not a whole lot of, I guess, inhaled poisons because, well, you know, cloud kills still goes through your skin.
Right, right. Well, you know what went through my mind? Let's take some of our mundane stuff and fill it with sand and then turn that sand into gold.
So, right, the way the trap was set up was all they had to do was cross the river. There wasn't another way to cross the river. There was no ford anywhere, or at least they didn't go looking for one, you know, a mile north or south or whatever. But every time they attempted to cross the water, the fireflies, these small glyphs, as it turned out, converged on their location. And this happened whether they attempted to swim across or water walk across or fly across or even teleport across. It prevented them from getting there and then did just gobs of elemental damage. It was tons of fun rolling so many D8s. It's just the best. And just randomly fire or lightning or cold. It was great on my end. The only way to get across was to swim under the water. But what they didn't know is that anything non-magical that the water touched turned to gold, which became a problem when the weaker characters were then suddenly encased in solid gold clothes.
As you do.
And commence the drowning.
Right, right. Yes.
But actually one thing that ended up tricking them a bit was that magic items got a charisma saving throw. Or at least I gave them a charisma saving throw. So the monk, Bastion, the Warforged monk, attempted to cross. He didn't have a whole lot of gear, so his tunic turned to gold, but he was able to struggle out of that because he was a monk. And though he actually made the charisma saves, lo and behold, on the rest of his magic items, so the rest of the party didn't know that their items were at risk because they didn't know what the charisma saves were for.
That would have been so heartbreaking.
They took off all their clothes and all their items, stuffed them in their bags of holding, and then swam under the water.
Yeah.
Since most of the party was charisma-based, they mostly succeeded, except for the bard whose bag of holding turned to solid gold.
Which we then had to put inside another bag of holding to carry it.
Okay, let it not be said that I am a cruel DM. I did allow them to come up with the solution. They suggested dispel magic. And I ruled that since it was within about 15 seconds of it turning to gold, that a successful dispel check did undo it. However, if that had not been successful or if they'd waited too long, yeah, she would have just lost all her items.
Oh, Lord. Good times.
But, it ended up not mattering later, so. Spoiler alert. We'll get to that eventually.
All right. Do you want to move on to our main topic?
Let's do.
All right. So alignment in D&D.
We're just gonna argue for this episode, yeah?
Well, let's start by talking about what alignment is.
Sure.
There are nine points.
It's made up. That's it doesn't exist.
So traditional D&D has 9 points. You've got a scale of law versus chaos, so lawful, neutral, chaotic, and then a scale of good versus evil. So you have good, neutral, evil. And then you can matrix those any way you want. Right. So lawful evil, chaotic good, whatever you want to do. True neutral.
And it's a really elegant system.
Yeah, I mean, if you think about it, if you had no alignment system, that's a pretty interesting way to kind of codify someone's morality and personality, right? In two quick terms, it tells you quite a bit of information.
Right. The problem comes because you want everything to fit in these 9 boxes.
That's, yeah, exactly.
Yeah. And because it is so elegant.
But historically, the problem was not only do you want to fit them into the 9 boxes, but for 3 full editions, you had to fit them into the boxes because those boxes were important mechanical restrictions.
Yep. God, I hated those.
Yeah. So your paladins in through 3.5, if you weren't lawful good.
Lawful good, yeah.
You lost all of your abilities.
Yeah, just couldn't be a paladin to begin with.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, but if you didn't maintain your alignment, you lost it. Or if you were, like a rogue or a bard, you had to be chaotic. You couldn't be lawful or neutral.
Right. You could be neutral, but you couldn't be lawful. Right?
So you had
meant that, no multiclassing, the rogue and monk.
Right.
Monk and barbarian. And then just ridiculous Unearthed Arcana shenanigans where you had paladins of freedom that were chaotic good.
Paladins, yeah, right.
And
exactly.
Paladins of tyranny that were lawful evil. And
right.
Those were interesting and those were neat ways to tell stories that people wanted to tell, but why have those restrictions in the first place?
Yeah, it was a bad basis for balance. So in 4E, they said, all right, we can fix this. We'll get rid of this crazy 9-point alignment and we'll introduce 5 points of alignment.
Womp, womp.
How'd that turn out?
It was the worst of both worlds.
It confused everybody.
Right. And it was just a line, right? So people thought it was more of a spectrum than it really was. So it went lawful good, good, unaligned, evil, chaotic evil. And so people thought, oh, that means lawful good is more good than good.
Right, right.
But it wasn't. It was just different.
Yeah, illogically so.
And then it, you know, it lost the elegance. It wasn't cool anymore because it didn't have any history or nostalgia attached to it. And it also just, it didn't help any, it didn't serve a purpose anymore.
And you could very easily find established fictional characters that just didn't fit into the five categories.
Yeah, yeah. You know, oh, it was I guess they're unaligned.
All right. Well, I can't describe my character in this system, so I guess this isn't important.
Right. Where does Robin Hood fit on like lawful good, good, unaligned?
I guess he's good.
Yeah, right. I guess he's good.
Yeah. I mean, he should be chaotic good.
Right. But yeah, because it doesn't tell me anything else about him.
Right. Exactly. You know? So the one benefit of 4E, though, was that alignment was non-mechanical. It was just descriptive.
Which I thought was great.
Yeah. And they carried that over to 5E. We went back to the 9-point alignment system, and it's supposed to be non-mechanical. There's no more class restrictions on alignment. So everyone's welcome to have an evil paladin or a chaotic monk.
Good.
Sort of.
Sort of.
Don't look in the DMG.
Right.
Because in the DMG, magic items are tuned to alignment at times. And the Oathbreaker Paladin is for losing your alignment.
Okay, so as someone who totally abhors the idea of alignment restriction items, I did give our paladin an item that was restricted based on alignment.
Not only that, but it attacked him as a result.
Because of his alignment. Yeah. Right, right. So, yeah, I mean,
you also gave your Inquisitor an item restricted by alignment, thus proving his alignment to the party.
Yes. It could only be used by evil characters.
For lawful greater good.
And our Inquisitor could not use it.
Oh, there was that. And the robes of the Archmagi. I had white robes.
Ah, yes, those as well, right?
Yeah.
So this is sort of the exception that proves the rule, right? We had already determined that there were characters who were playing not particular alignments, but particular characters and particular stories that happened to fit very neatly into these particular boxes, right? So we had a character, the paladin, who was attempting to move from lawful neutral to lawful good or neutral. He was attempting to move in the good direction, you know?
Right. He was trying to bury the hatchet on his vengeance,
right,
and move towards greater good.
Right, which, you know, we'll get to in future episodes why he was actually doing that. But giving him an item that was restricted based on alignment was just sort of an easy way to telegraph whether or not he was being successful at something that he was already wanting to do on his own,
right,
not something that I sort of thrust upon him or that the DMG thrust upon him.
Right, right. So we have talked about a missing scale in alignment, which is we call the third axis.
The Z axis?
Exactly.
Yeah.
The active versus passive scale. So the idea here being, if you're active in your alignment, you are imposing or promoting your worldview. And if you're passive, you're simply living by it.
Now, that feels to me more like it's active and neutral. Does that make sense? That it's one end of the scale, the center of the scale, and then no sort of opposing opposite pole. Because if you think about it, like evil, neutral, good, evil is opposed to good, but then there's neutral who doesn't really pursue either one. Isn't that also sort of passive?
Fair enough. I mean, I think for me, it's more a question of whether these are beliefs or whether these are actions.
So what you're saying is this third axis isn't another sort of tripartite axis, right? It's just two. You're introducing.
Yes. Yeah, yeah, right. Yeah, definitely.
Okay.
Yeah. It's not like there's a neutral in there. Right. Though I'm sure as soon as you establish two, someone's going to argue they're in the middle. So you might as well.
Right. So three-dimensionally now, we have 18 alignments.
Yeah, okay. Just a mere 18.
Okay. I mean, I thought we were heading toward 27, so. Yeah,
you know. No, and not something that you necessarily need to codify, but a good thing to think about is whether you treat your alignment as the way you think the world should be or whether your alignment is how you conduct yourself.
Right.
So let's talk about uses for alignment when creating characters.
So when you create a character, do you usually come up with their alignment or their outlook first, or do you create a character and then go, okay, what would this character do? What would they feel or think?
I go for the second.
Yeah, me too.
With the occasional exception, if we're playing a heroic campaign, I go for the latter. If we're doing something a little bit different where we're either trying to play scoundrels or we're actively evil or something like that, then obviously I kind of start with an idea of alignment and then work into a character that fits in there. At the end of the day, my alignment is a description of how I think my character is going to act rather than a box that I'm trying to fit my character into.
Yeah, I think even characters that end up being defined by their alignment, right? Like old school paladins, you don't start off thinking, ah, I want to play a lawful good character and, oh, perhaps I should try a paladin. No, you say, I want to be a paragon of justice and virtue. I want to play a knight in shining armor. I'm a paladin.
Right.
Oh, yeah, he's lawful good.
Yeah, I mean, he has to be now.
I mean,
he's a paragon of virtue.
Right.
Yeah, so some questions that I think of. What's my character's moral compass? You know, does he strongly identify one way or the other? Does he have a strong personal code? This is obviously more on the law and chaos side, but if I'm a monk, I might not follow the law, but I probably have a very regimented routine. I wake up every morning, I do the same thing. I conduct myself, I have body discipline. I have all these lawful characteristics, even though I don't really care about the law of your country.
See, now we're getting into the weeds again.
Exactly.
Right? Because this was the argument in 3.5 for monks having to be lawful and only lawful. But does a disciplined lifestyle, does that equate to a lawful alignment? I mean,
yes.
I always think of the quintessential real life monk as Bruce Lee, but this is also the man who said, you know, be like water. When poured into a teapot, it becomes the teapot. To me, it's almost the essence of chaos.
Also, yes. I don't see why it can't be both.
In 3.5, it couldn't be both.
That's because 3.5 had mechanical implications. and that's my point, right?
Like, so then if it doesn't matter and it's wishy-washy, then why even bother with it?
Because going through this thought process helps you define your character. The value of the exercise is in doing the exercise, not necessarily the outcome that you determine.
I don't really see, but I'm getting there. Maybe if we continue this exercise.
All right. So think of it as, does your character prefer structure or freedom?
Both.
Neutral. I like it.
Both a lot.
Active neutral. I like it.
I mean, I do think this is one drawback, not necessarily a drawback, but one issue I have with the alignment system is that it's almost like eye color, like it's stamped onto your sheet one time and it's supposed to stay that way or change, you know, very slowly. But I think in quote unquote real life or maybe realistic characters, in different situations, you act very differently, right? Among your friends, maybe you're highly chaotic, but then at work, you're highly lawful.
Yeah, definitely. And that's, you know, characters have free will.
What?
I know, it's strange. And not only that, but good people sometimes do bad things. And bad people sometimes do good things. It doesn't make them
good
people. Well, hey. But mistakes happen. Exceptions happen. Characters can be as complex as people.
Yeah. So I think basically what we're getting at is don't use alignment mechanically, but it can be a very useful tool for helping GMs understand a particular character's goals. And then also for helping you as a player figure out exactly how your character interacts with the world.
Yeah. So do you use your alignment then as a prescriptive thing or as a descriptive thing?
Why don't you explain some of that for our listeners?
All right. So if it's prescriptive, you are trying to fit your character's actions into the alignment that best describes him at that moment. If it's descriptive, you are doing what your character will do and then letting your alignment follow.
I think we all do a little bit of both. I mean, most people, I think, would say they do the latter, right?
No, my GM says that I am lawful good, and thus I cannot do that.
Well, then do what your GM says.
GM's always right.
Or find a new group.
Until he's wrong. And then I leave.
That's right. So I think most people, and you know, in general, when you're playing your character, right, you just do what your character would do. And an alignment evolves from that. You can look back over the last 10 sessions and be like, oh, yeah, I mean, I'm totally chaotic evil.
So that, I think, is the problem, is when you start veering towards extremes and when your actions seem just completely out of line with the expectations that other people have, whether that's drawn from alignment or it's just drawn from the social contract or the character that you've described to that point, alignment is the easiest thing on your sheet to point to say, that seems very out of character.
Well, I think it's certainly useful in character as well to think, okay, there are ideals that this character strives toward. They may not always meet those. And maybe on looking back on the last 10 sessions, that character then goes, oh, I have not been living up to my ideals. I'm chaotic neutral. Okay. I don't know why I murdered all those hobos.
Wait, I don't know why I've been living like a hobo this whole time.
Right, I should settle down.
I should be a murder noble.
I should spend this gold. You know, yeah. So certainly it is an easy way to point out that a character maybe is not acting in the way that they've at least been described. It doesn't need to be a straitjacket where, hey, you wrote this on your sheet and so you need to act this way. But it's, hey, these don't really match up. Is the sheet wrong? Is your character evolving in some way? What's happening here?
Right. If it's a case where it is meant to be an exception, think about the character implications for that, because it's perfectly acceptable for a PC to have a crisis of conscience or, you know, a moral dilemma and regret as a result.
So much regret.
In a lot of ways, I think what makes a good GM great is his ability to bring about those types of moral dilemmas for his character or for his players.
So let's get esoteric. Okay, what about creatures that don't get to decide their alignment? Because okay, we've all looked through the Monster Manual, both like the current Monster Manual and certainly older ones that say, oh, this creature, its alignment, always evil. Every single one of these things that you're going to meet, evil. Horribly, irredeemably evil.
Yeah, I mean, that's fiends, right? Your devils and your demons. They're either beings of evil and chaos, if you're a demon, or a being of evil and law, if you're a devil.
And in some settings, literally made up physically of some sort of substance called law.
Right.
Yeah, it's a little weird.
Yeah.
But then what about usually evil? Orcs, yeah?
Yeah, I mean, I think that one you've got to look towards your setting and how you want to portray that setting as to where you draw the line of who has free will.
It is one of my favorite things about the Eberron setting is that alignment is not tied to race.
Yeah, right? Except for dragons. It drives me nuts. It's such an easy color-coded scheme. Why did you throw that out, Keith Baker? Just let me know if I'm talking to a red dragon. I can't trust him. If I'm talking to a gold dragon, he's great.
That was my favorite, right? Look, it's a silver dragon. Silver dragon. Oh, good. Whew. And he attacks. But why? We're good. Yep.
Yep. Also tasty.
Kill the red dragon. Ooh, yeah. Well, you know, she is the benevolent dictator of this village.
Right,
so.
Right. But in seriousness, I think that does create a problem where as players, we want free will and we don't want to be bound to the boxes of the 9-point alignment system. But then as a GM, you are stuck filtering your NPCs and particularly generally your villains through this lens of the 9 boxes because your players understand that. And so you can't have a benevolent demon or a slovenly devil because that doesn't stay true to the devil.
In the context that you've already set up for the game, yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I think that it certainly can be restrictive to your storytelling. I mean, sometimes it is useful in condensing things. It is useful to have a shorthand that everyone understands, but it's been around so long. It's such this old trope that everyone uses now that it's almost difficult at times for some people to think outside it or to comprehend something outside it. Like even just when you said benevolent demon, right? Like my brain just sort of went like, that wait, what?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. But like it should be possible. We should be able to make a story that has a benevolent demon.
Or at least a greater evil.
Like, yeah.
Willing to do good now in order to do more evil later. Like setting you up for the eventual fall. Though actually I think you handled that very well in the Morning Glory campaign with Behemoth, the bound devil in the chalice that accompanied us through much of our latter adventures.
Oh, Behemoth.
I mean, I've already told you he's one of my favorite NPCs, but there were different points in time where we needed to trust Behemoth in order to get whatever we were trying to get and basically had to like huddle up and take a vote. And it just came down to like, how can we trust him? He's a devil. At some point, he has to attempt to betray us. And at one point, he broke free. That wasn't good. At other times, his justification was literally like, look, I'm not the biggest guy in the block. So if you let those fiends free, they're probably going to come after me too. So, you know, it's like enemy of my enemy is my friend kind of thing. I don't generally advance good goals, but I also don't want to become the servant of a fiendish overlord who's going to be way worse for me than I am right now.
Yeah. I mean, that is one of the best things about devils, but of course you should also be able to do that with a demon. But yeah, it's in the shorthand that we use, it's difficult to even comprehend.
I know. Demons are, I think, chaotic evil as a box is much more difficult to apply nuance.
Yeah, it's hard to think of a chaotic evil creature saying, well, you know, I want to cause more evil later.
Yeah, I'm going to play the long con right. On this one. why wouldn't I play the short con and the long con? But that's evil stupid, right? Mm-hmm. If you think about it, the same way that lawful good gets treated as lawful stupid, chaotic evil gets treated as chaotic stupid. And it's no more useful. I mean, there's no reason that a chaotic evil creature, person, whomever, couldn't have schemes and plots. It's just that his schemes and plots are going to be a very different nature from, you know, perhaps a lawful evil creature.
You know, you're right. You've convinced me. I think we should stop discriminating against chaotic evil.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Chaotic evil has rights too.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
You gotta fight for your right.
That's right. They'll rip them out of your throat.
Yeah. Well, you know.
But yeah. Now they've got those rights. They have the right to do that.
All right. So let's talk about some fictional characters and see if we can't squeeze them into one of these boxes.
Okay. So onto the fighting. Okay.
Yeah. So Darth Vader and the Emperor from Star Wars.
Okay. Well, so the Emperor is a lot easier, right? Because he doesn't waffle. Darth Vader can't make up his mind.
Oh, you're gonna play that angle on Darth Vader.
So the Emperor Palpatine, he's lawful evil.
Definitely lawful evil.
Right. Yeah. Vader, I mean, okay, what episode?
I mean, if you look at his whole arc, he's probably spends most of his time neutral evil, right?
In the pod race, he was definitely neutral evil. Did you see how he treated 3PO and his mom, right? He was like, hey, later, mom.
Yeah, he's totally.
Sucks being a slave, huh?
Totally, yeah.
Okay, so let's ignore sort of the
prequels.
Or even just like the very end, right? Like his redemption. Like that's the point. It's a story of his redemption, right? Yeah, let's talk about most of the time we see him on screen.
Let's talk about Black Mask, Black Cape Vader.
He's certainly evil.
Definitely evil.
Right? I mean, he chokes people for no reason.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, for
bad reasons.
Reasons of enforcing discipline.
Ah.
A rather lawful act, no?
I think we determined Chain's alignment. Look, it was okay because, you know, you had to keep people in line. I mean, how else are you going to keep people in line?
Look, I didn't say it was good.
I just said it makes sense to me. I
said it was lawful. So, I mean, do you think he's lawful or neutral?
I think he's neutral.
I do too.
Strong chaotic tendencies, right? Like easily gives into his rage.
That's
especially when he's younger. Actually, I would say like episode 3, chaotic evil.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think he definitely starts chaotic as Hayden Christensen.
Yeah.
And then as he moves into the original trilogy, he becomes more lawful. And I think he moves towards neutral. Because like you said, the fight against Luke is so unnecessary. If he were truly adhering to law and order and the things that he were supposed to be doing as his station, he would have just killed him.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's his son. Couldn't quite follow that order. I think that tips him a little bit. And there's probably an element of pride there too, the way he springs the trap in Cloud City rather than simply shooting them out of the air.
Yeah, I mean, it only took him 19 years to learn that maybe you shouldn't kill the person you love most in the world.
You get there eventually. All right, so how about Luke?
Luke, good, obviously.
Yeah.
And like, that's his arc, right? He's naively good.
Yeah, annoyingly good.
Yeah. I think neutral. I mean, that's the thing. Luke, honestly, isn't a particularly strong character. And I think sometimes what happens is you sort of slam them into the middle box.
Okay.
Sure, he's like, oh, I don't want to like be a moisture farmer. But that's not really chaotic. Who the hell wants to be a moisture farmer?
He develops a stronger personal discipline as a Jedi, right? Right. So I think Jedi in general tend towards a more lawful alignment. But it's not like until the extended universe, he's not particularly lawful. He's really struggling with that.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And maybe at the very end of Return of the Jedi, does he kind of, he finally prizes that discipline over, well, frankly, his own life. He risks it for that discipline, right? He refuses to kill Vader.
Right. And given to his chaotic tendencies.
Right.
Yeah. I think this, just the conversation so far sort of highlights one of the problems with the 9 boxes is the characters that we remember the most tend to be the ones on the extreme ends of the alignment. And that doesn't mean that ones in the middle aren't good characters. Like a true neutral character who's like principled in their neutrality, both spectrums, is can be a very interesting character, but we don't usually, you know, those don't usually stick in our heads, at least in media.
Unless they move a lot.
Yeah, right. That's true.
It's fine to be neutral if you're moving one way or the other. So I went ahead and skipped Han Solo because, I mean, his arc is like the most clear redemptive arc of the Star Wars trilogy. But
he's obviously lawful neutral. Yeah.
Mal Reynolds from Firefly. Ooh. Everyone's real Ooh-hoo. Favorite scoundrel.
Yeah. And then this begs the question, like, what determines your alignment? Is it your actions in the moment take, you know, your actions in the moment, little by little, the tiny things you do all the time, or your ideals that you could live up to if you were given the chance?
So the question I think you're alluding to is the fact that Mal is a smuggler and, you know, a rogue type who lives on the outside of the law.
An admitted thief.
Right. Yeah. Does that make him chaotic versus does his personal discipline, his loyalty to his crew, his military service in the brown coats, those ideals, does that make him more neutral or lawful?
See, this is interesting because that's not what I was talking about.
You were
about.
Talking the good versus neutral?
Yeah, totally was. Okay. I think he's totally chaotic.
I think he's neutral good.
Really?
See, I very much think he struggles with the fact that he's stuck on the outside. I don't think that's where his happiness comes from.
I think he's happy on the outside, and he would be happy on the outside if life wasn't not hard, right? He's fine with the hard life. Grew up on a ranch. He just wishes it wasn't hard for everyone, that you didn't need to take from other people in order for you to have enough. If everyone had like a little bit, like enough to get by, I think you'd be like, okay, yeah, this is good. Everyone sort of leaves each other alone. That's great.
Yeah, it sounds pretty neutral good to me.
That sounds chaotic good. He doesn't want to deal with the long arm of the Alliance.
See, that to me is more of a hatred, not of the law of the Alliance, mm-hmm. but of the hypocrisy of the Alliance.
Well, then we sort of get into, you know, what was the purpose of the Unification War?
Right.
Right? Was it fought over?
Over law and order or over good and evil?
Right.
I mean, I think in his case, he thought it was good versus evil.
I think he thought it was law versus order, especially at the very beginning. Right, because
are we talking about the first scene of the pilot?
Yeah, he is loud and he is brash and he doesn't follow orders. He makes up orders. That does not sound. He was a loyal soldier, but not a lawful soldier.
Hmm.
However, I'm not saying this is definitely. Mal Reynolds does not fit in a box.
That's right. Nobody puts Mal Reynolds in a box.
That's right.
All right, Boromir, Lord of the Rings. He obviously gave in to temptation,
right?
But I don't think he's an evil character.
No, I think he's morally neutral.
Okay. See, I think he was willing to give his life for the quest, and I think that makes him
lawful.
No, I think that makes him good.
See, now again, another problem with the nine boxes, right? It's not very granular,
right?
You know,
right.
I mean, if I could, I would put Boromir between morally neutral and good.
Yeah, fair enough. I could buy that.
You know,
good tending neutral.
Yeah, but of course you need space on the scale for his brother Faramir, who's just straight up good.
Just good. Yeah. And lawful though, right?
Yeah, lawful and good.
Despite being a ranger.
Right.
This doesn't make sense.
I don't understand. Yeah.
So we think he's lawful neutral? Boromir?
Boromir? I do, yeah.
Okay.
I think lawful neutral. Okay. But could, yeah, tending toward, had he lived, I think he would have ended up good.
See, interesting. I could make the case for neutral good as well. In ideal, if not in... Obviously, he failed. He failed himself. But he recognized that.
So why is he... there's another problem with D&D in general, right? They use the same terms over and over again for everything. So on the law chaos scale, why neutral? Why not lawful? Doesn't he basically do everything that's asked of him?
Yeah, except that... He also understood his own internal demons. He knew that inner temptation
mm-hmm.
towards that chaos.
But didn't act on it.
Well, I mean, he did.
One time he did. But was the size of the transgression enough to move him an entire block on the scale?
I would say that his belief was that he could... circumvent all of the planning to destroy the ring mm-hmm. and better do it himself.
I mean, that's just because he's human. I mean, put any human up against the ring and like they're going to say, oh, yeah, no, I could do this. I should do this.
Okay, maybe. Fair enough.
How about this? Instead of the 9 boxes, we're going to make each axis an 11-point scale, 0 to 10.
Okay, so 100 okay? And... yeah, this is going to work. 121.
Yeah, exactly. And then when we refer to alignments, we just do the x-axis and then the y-axis.
But what about active and passive?
The third...
That's binary.
Right. Yeah, exactly. We'll just add a third integer. Okay, no problem.
Perfect.
And then everyone will totally understand what you mean when you say, you know, oh, actually, we should center it so 0 is neutral.
Oh,
so,
yeah.
Yeah, that's way that's better.
Perfect. Yeah. We're basically playing GURPS now.
Okay. So let's move away from fantasy for a bit and head toward comic books. Tony Stark.
Let's talk Marvel Cinematic Universe, Tony Stark.
Okay.
Just because I don't read comic books.
RDJ.
Yeah.
Okay.
Definitely good. Come on. He shuts down his company's weapons program.
Yeah, no, I'll agree with you. I'm just trying to take it. I mean, there's like 45 movies, you know, so I'm trying to shuffle through all of them.
3 Iron Mans, 2 Avengers.
Yeah.
But then I think he's chaotic. He struggles with the rules, right? I mean, he's just classic chaotic good, in my opinion. He always does what he thinks best, regardless of agreements, regardless of rules, regardless of structures. He does the best that he can in his mind.
Right. I might say big C chaotic, little G good.
Yeah, that's probably accurate.
Because, like, you know, if the two come into conflict, he'll pick chaos.
Oh, definitely.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because he gets bored easily.
Oh, yeah.
Speaking of bored easily, Captain Jack Sparrow.
Well, chaotic.
Chaotic neutral.
Neutral,
right?
Yep. Yeah. Sort of the epitome of chaotic neutral.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Yeah. Almost like actively chaotic neutral.
Yeah.
Right? Mm-hmm. He promotes both chaos and whatever side is winning, fighting against them. He doesn't care for good or evil. He only cares for keeping things on level. Like, he doesn't want the good guys to get too far ahead or the bad guys to fall too far behind.
Right. I mean, if you think about the movies, he isn't an impetus for the plot. He just sort of exists as a piece of the setting.
The best piece of the setting.
Right. Not Davy Jones's octopus face.
Right. All right, so we're running long on time, but let's knock out 2 more comic book characters.
Okay.
Batman and the Joker.
I mean, okay, so the Joker is yet another Avatar character, right? He is chaotic evil. He's the epitome of chaotic evil.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
And active chaos.
Yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, he is trying to make the world worse and more difficult to understand.
Mm-hmm. Now, Batman... Ooh, I mean, there's been a lot of argument over this. I mean, I'm gonna go good.
I would agree with good.
And then the question is he chaotic or is he neutral?
Does his personal code override his vigilantism?
Right. And then, of course, keeping in mind that most of the laws that he's breaking are often created by corrupt politicians anyway.
Right. So, and would he need to break those laws if he lived or existed in a different type of world?
Honestly, I can easily see an argument for him being lawful good.
I would make the lawful good.
Yeah, he's got a hell of a code.
I mean, he's an Avenger. I mean, not literally one of the Avengers, but right, he is of Paladin of Vengeance.
I was just going to say.
Like, he's a Dark Knight.
Yep. I agree with you.
He's also the world's greatest detective.
He's optimal cockiness.
Yeah.
Obviously.
All right. Do you hear that, Ishan?
I do. It is my former preconceptions crumbling.
Oh, odd that sounds so similar to the Character Creation Forge. But before we move on to the Character Creation Forge, let's talk about how our listeners can get in contact with us.
We do love hearing from you.
You can tweet at Shane at Mundangerous. That's M-U-N dangerous.
And you can tweet at Ishan at Evil Sans Carne. That's malice minus meat.
And you can tweet at the show at TPTcast. You can also email us if you can't fit it into 140 characters at TotalPartyThrill@gmail.com. And last, you can find us on the web at www.TotalPartyThrillCast.com.
So, for the Forge this time, we have got another single build and 2 backstories.
This week, we built the Smuggler, and it should come as no surprise, it involves some rogue.
What? So, what kinds of things does a proper smuggler need to be able to do?
So a smuggler needs to be able to hide things. First and foremost, there's no point in smuggling if you can't find places to hide things.
Okay, I got a bag of holding. Done.
Yeah. Okay. You got your bag of holding. What happens if you get stopped for inspection?
I put my bag of holding in my other bag of holding.
And then they both explode. That's a bad idea. You should talk your way out of it.
Oh, that's a good idea.
Yeah. And then if that doesn't work,
pocket sand.
Shoot it out.
Yeah. Okay. Okay. That's good too. I like shooting.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Or, you know, create a distraction and slip away in the chaos.
Agreed.
So how can we do this in 5th edition? Well, I recommend taking 6 levels of rogue, that's the arcane trickster, and then 14 levels of sorcerer. And the key here is that rogue 6, you will get expertise in
4
skills. Mm-hmm. Those are going to be definitely deception, probably also persuasion.
Sleight of hand,
and then probably stealth.
Yeah, I mean, I would like to get animal handling in there because, you know, usually you're smuggling exotic animals, right?
I mean, do you want to be transporting via an animal or something like that? So I would train that as a skill, but I don't know that I necessarily expertise that.
Fine. Is animal handling not big in Morning Glory?
No.
Yeah, I guess it wasn't. Sorry.
Because the only person who used animals was our paladin, who could just find steed and then telepathically communicate. So, you know.
It didn't tip you guys off that he summoned a nightmare?
Oh, no, we noticed. And then when he turned good, he summoned a daymare.
Yeah, not as intimidating.
But then between arcane trickster and sorcerer, you'll have a lot of little tricky maneuvers that you can use. The arcane trickster gets the mage hand ledger domain, which lets him manipulate objects from afar. Sorcerer has a solid spell list of illusion and transmutation spells.
And subtle spell.
Subtle spell and quicken spell. Mm-hmm. Yeah, the two metamagic abilities that will allow you to tip things in your favor on the fly without anybody noticing that you're using magic.
Right, or make something invisible without moving.
That also helps.
What? There was nothing there. What are you talking about?
Yeah, I don't like...
Huh? What?
I guess there's no exotic animals here. And if all else fails, you know, you could just polymorph them.
You mean the inspectors, right?
Yeah, I mean, or the exotic animals. Right. Just, you know.
These are perfectly legal fish.
Right. Yeah, these beta fish.
Right, yeah. They're obviously not chimeras.
That way you can fight them. Like they unpolymorph themselves. Right.
They just attack that mirror.
Right, exactly. And then, of course, you probably also want to take twin spells so that you can use your transmutation concentration spells on multiple targets.
Now, while I do like your use of arcane trickster here, I will say that if you feel like you can get by on just 14 levels of sorcerer, you can go up to rogue 6 with the assassin path just so that your smuggler can shoot first. I think that's important.
I mean, there is at least one famous smuggler who shot first.
I mean, it's a long way to go for it, but...
Yeah, that's a pretty big reach.
I guess you could just take alert.
Yeah, that's fine. Another option would be to take Bard. Instead of going to 6 levels of rogue, you could take 3 levels of Bard at some point to get the expertise from the Bard class, and then you get some more caster levels.
Even more expertise, yeah. Ooh, you could do like a Friar Tuck smuggler level of cleric and just all the expertises.
Yeah, but knowledge isn't that useful as a smuggler. I mean, at least...
also all the expertises.
It's just all of the forge, skill monkeys. So when all else fails, skill monkeys.
Sorry, we'll build you a combat monster soon. We'll just wreck encounters.
All right, so story idea here. Tell me about your smuggler. How does he fit into a campaign?
So he starts as a small town stage magician. It may seem a little weird, right? Like, he starts as a rogue. But in the real world, what's a stage magician? It's just someone who's really good at sleight of hand. So that's what he is. In fact, he thinks that's all there is. He doesn't believe in magic. He's from this small little town where no one's actually seen a real wizard. You hear stories about them, but so do we. And do you actually believe they exist? So,
yes, I do. Still real to me.
You'll get your letter from Hogwarts one of these days.
Chris Angel mind freaks me every time.
So he's in this small town, you know, he's making a living, but life has lost its magic and its luster, and he's just sort of going through the motions until one day he realizes, huh, this is weird. I didn't really try that hard to make this happen, but something did. Because, turns out sorcerer's bloodline. What? That's right. And now a wider world is opened up to him, and he knows that he can't live the life that he had before. Sure, they'll come in useful, right? He's a fast talker. He's got fast fingers. But now he's got to go out and explore this real magic, this magical side of his heritage. He's got to get out of town. He's got to join up with some people who are not afraid of this kind of thing and who have the capability of helping him locate items or experiences that will explore this. And of course, that's adventurers.
Nice, nice.
Also, he can, you know, hide animals in all kinds of places. So right, they definitely right. want him around. I mean, who yeah. wouldn't want that around?
I mean, you don't just find anybody casting Firebolt just anywhere.
Except in taverns.
Yeah. Like every tavern.
Yeah.
All right. So I went with a similar humble beginnings approach.
I mean, that is what level one is.
That's true. So my smuggler begins as a member of a traveling circus or like a traveling troupe of entertainers. They could be acrobats or he could just be a roadie. It doesn't really matter. The key is...
Gross.
The key is he has like a small ring of bandits that he's a part of, and they pull small jobs and pickpocketing and that sort of thing in each town that they visit. They kind of prey on the crowd, right? He quickly realizes that he's much better at hiding, moving, and fencing the merch that they steal than he is at actually doing the heavy lifting. And so he kind of adopts this alternate role as every town he goes to, he's in the business of moving things very discreetly. You know, he's already on the road. He's got the perfect cover ID, and that's what he does now. And he uses magic to sort of supplement his abilities to hide things and find places for them, particularly in plain sight.
I feel like he'd get recruited pretty quickly as a spy.
Oh, yeah. That's a very spy type kind of skill set. But then, you know, somehow he crosses paths with the party. Either he screws over somebody.
Can we say screws over?
Yeah, why not?
Sure.
Makes a common enemy and has some information to share with a party, or perhaps he owes somebody something and that person also hires the party. Any myriad reasons that he could end up with the party. As long as he's dealing in shady business, very focused on his profits, I'm sure he'll find an adventuring party at some point.
Maybe the merchandise that needs to be smuggled is the party.
Oh, but why does he stay with the party?
Love.
Oh, he finds love. So special.
Money. The money's good.
You know, you lose your head in this game for 1 second.
Right? Yeah. Suddenly you got, you know.
People get hurt.
You got half-elf kids. You'll be dead long before they reach adulthood. Or you'll watch them grow old.
All right. That's a dark turn. Well, we're starting to run long, so you can find the show on iTunes. And if our dark turns in the last half of the show don't run you off, you could leave us a 5-star review and we'll be happy to read it on the air. You can also find us on Stitcher. Stitcher's like a Pandora for podcasts. If you give us a like or a favorite, that will add us into your queue and tell the Stitcher algorithm to give you other content similar to our show. And it will also help other listeners find our show. And this week we actually have another 5-star review.
What?
I know. This is "Really Enjoy What I'm Hearing." 5 stars by Wolfish Hunger. I'm the Matt mentioned in Lorebard's review. I really enjoy your podcast. Awesome audio quality and great sections that are both the perfect length and informative, with the right amount of fun sprinkled on top. I hope to game and or drink with you guys in the near future. It's possible. Keep at it.
I'm down.
Yeah, we love drinks and friends.
Yeah, friends, yeah. I will say the reason the segments are the right length, that is thanks to the editing of Shane.
I spend a lot of time editing because we're not that good live. Someday we should do a live show just so people can see like really how bad we are.
And swearing and trying to rewind.
Oh, yeah. But that is not going to be next week's episode. What is next week's episode, Ishan?
We'll be talking about homebrew.
And in the Character Creation Forge?
We're building a much better mastermind than the one in the Sword Coast Player's Guide.
Man, they really struck a nerve.
Yeah. We'll show you how to do it properly.
We can build it better, faster, stronger.
Harder. You forgot harder.
I didn't want to have to pay the royalty to Daft Punk.
well, now they know.
Oh, I blew it. Damn. That wasn't very mastermindly. That's it for unlucky episode number 13, where we now owe royalty of Total Party Thrill. I hope we've lived up to our name, but either way, I'm Shane.
And I'm Ishan. Thanks for listening.